Now, friends, we are, most of us anyway, are bleary-eyed from trying to follow with fingers crossed the outcome of the midterm elections, which took place on Tuesday, but lots of votes yet to be counted. But I know somebody, you know, who in fact has more than a passing interest in the outcome of the election, because he and Brian O'Dwyer and John Fitzpatrick and many others are indeed holding bated breath the finality of these results. Neil O'Dowd, you're very welcome.
Good morning, Adrian. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm fine. Before we tackle anything else, are we all feeling, you know, that for the first time, the uncertainty of the election results are keeping us, you know, on our toes, more so than at any time in recent political history in the United States?
Well, you know, it seems like we've been living through almost a nightmare. And this election is incredibly important in terms of the American people standing up for democracy and saying that we've had enough of these election deniers, we've had enough of the nonsense surrounding the whole abusive behavior. I mean, the fact that Paul Pelosi, Nancy's husband, 84 years old, could be attacked in his own home, and some of the major Republicans just kind of laughed about it. And I think what we saw was a tremendous return to normality, where the electorate voted very clearly in favor of getting things done rather than settling scores and looking at the past and imaginary vote counts, which had never happened. So I think it was a great day for democracy, even, and everybody, of course, is still waiting to see who will take over the House and the Senate, which is incredible if you think how heavy a favorite the Republicans were for both seats.
All right. Let me tell you, and I think most people were attuned to the notion that what was referred to as the red wave, that's a you know, symbol of republicanism, that was going to shock the whole lot of us, and we could go away.
It turned
and
into a red
stay away for the next
It was just a red wee-wee, it wasn't a wave. But I think it's indicative of just how far people had gone, that, you know, everything that was being talked about before the election was how big would the Republican margin be, was this the end for Joe Biden, and all these other questions. And once again, Adrian, the polls were completely off the wall and completely wrong. So, you know, you're flying blind these days, because people are clearly not telling the truth. I know you don't tell the truth about anything, but these voters, in terms of getting opinion polls right, this has been the third or fourth election now that they got it wrong. This red wave never appeared.
Yeah. Are you telling the truth there? Yeah, I suppose you are. You're on your best behavior. Before we leave that topic, the one thing is clear at this point, particularly when you have a lot of smirking Democrats hoping that former President Donald Trump is going to shock us all this week. You know, talk about marketing strategy. You know, strategy. He's going to make this big announcement, you know, this coming week of his re-entry into the 2024 election. And I think there's a fairly good reason for Democrats to, you know, pre-celebrate, as it were, that kind of a matchup.
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, the bubble has burst with regards to Trump. And that was obvious from the kind of candidates that he picked and the kind of, you know, beatings that they took from regular politicians. I think the whole thing comes back to people suddenly waking up and realizing, you know, even we came very close to losing democracy. We came very close to the vice president being hanged. We came very close to a revolution with people charging police and Capitol Police on the barricades on January 6th. And people do process that information, and this was really the first chance they got to express their opinions. And their opinion was obviously expressed very loudly on that issue of democracy and also on the issue of abortion, where so many of the people, you know, felt that they had been disenfranchised, and this bunch of old men in the Supreme Court had decided what a woman could and couldn't do. So I think it was an overwhelmingly surprising election, but finally surprising in a very good way, because people just want to go back to normal. They don't want to be carrying on this kind of hatred and conflict that's been, unfortunately, what's been happening the last couple of years. I mean, we could trust, you know, like even in Britain, you had these terrible sort of furore over who was going to be prime minister or whatever. And you come back to America and you see the same kind of unrest. It's very bad for democracy, because people begin to question, does this system work at all? And in fact, as the American people proved on Tuesday, it actually worked beautifully in terms of getting the point of view of people across in a massive scale that enough is enough.
Neil, a bit closer to home for New Yorkers, of course, history made again, you know, with two wonderful Irish-American women, you know, Maura Healey, first woman governor of Massachusetts, and has also, you know, declared a lesbian, you know. And then we have our own Kathy Courtney Hochul, who became New York's first elected woman governor. You know,
what? I mean, extraordinary.
Amazing, you know.
It's amazing, Adrian, that there never had been a woman elected governor of Massachusetts or New York until this year. If you think of the fact that the politics in New York and Massachusetts are usually very liberal, and yes, it took two tough Irish women to come forward and fight the battle and make it happen. I mean, you know Kathy Hochul, and you know that she's a very, very talented person who was in the right place at the right time when Andrew Cuomo was forced to resign. But I have found her to be very impressive and also very proud of her Irish heritage. I mean, Debbie McGoldrick interviewed her soon after she was elected, and she talked for a solid half hour about her roots in County Kerry and going back and forth and what a tough life her immigrant parents had when they came over here, at one point ending up living in a trailer park. So you look at that and you become so proud of the fact that the Irish, you know, can rise from absolutely nothing, but also that this country gave them the opportunity. And the same with Maura Healey, you know, she was fighting the odds as a gay woman to begin with, but she persevered and won a huge landslide victory. And the thing that helped her the most, by all accounts, was her opponent was supported by Donald Trump. So it just shows you how things work.
Yeah. Now, in no small way, I think credit can be given. And what, at the end of the day, was quite a tight election with, you know, between Kathy Hochul, you know, and Lee Zeldin, who was the Republican nominee, and to pitch those together, one would say that yes, of course, it was touch and go, and for those of us who were, you know, praying that she would make it, the odds were not in her favor. But it is, I think, acknowledged too that the influence of the Irish American committee, of which you remember Ted Smith, and of course the chairman of the Gaming Commission, Brian O'Dwyer, and so many others, that effort and that push was indeed obviously very helpful to the election of Kathy Hochul.
Yeah, and you know, Zeldin proves to be a very tough opponent. And I thought of you, Adrian, when I read that he got $10 million from Ronald Lauder, who I think you might remember was going to run for mayor many years ago and was on your show. But, you know, it was really Zeldin. I mean, when you look across the country, the irony of this is that the fact that Long Island has now four Republican congressmen indicates, like, Tom Swasey's seat went Republican and all that. It was different to the national trend where Democrats were picking up seats. And I think Zeldin is probably the most talented Republican since Bloomberg or George Pataki. And I don't think we've heard the end of him. He's only 42. But in the end, I think the Irish and her ethnic group and the African Americans and the big vote in the city, big vote in Buffalo, where she comes from. So she was running against history and she succeeded, but probably a little bit too close in terms of how we felt about that race, that she may well win easily, but it wasn't that easy in the end.
Yeah. Now, again, acknowledging, and we would have to at this point, that the success of Kathy Courtney Hochul as you know, as governor of New York, isn't it ironic that success did not indeed help in any way the congressional representatives in New York State? I think that was a two shocks back to back there.
I mean, there was two parts of the country that didn't vote Democrat. One was Florida and the other was New York. And Florida, you would expect, because they had a very popular mayor there, or sorry, governor, and he had been in the limelight and making all kinds of headlines, and you know, Florida has been going that way for some time anyway. Mm. But New York, I think, was a big shock. I think the biggest shock of the election was Sean Patrick Maloney, who actually runs the Democratic Congressional Committee, losing his seat in upstate New York. And again, it's an example of where Zeldin got a huge vote outside the major city, and I think he helped bring in Republicans who normally wouldn't have had a chance. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think it's proving very ironic, because as we talk, the difference between the Democrats becoming Speaker and electing a Speaker and the Republicans is about four seats. And you could look at Long Island and there's four seats that Democratic Party had every expectation they would win.
Let's move to Northern Ireland, and also, you know, your own article, and what raised a couple of you know, hairs in the back of the necks of the current government, and it is, of course, And I think it should be acknowledged that when we say the American influence on peace in Northern Ireland, the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, as we head into the, believe it or not, 25th anniversary coming up in April, can you bring us back to the lead-up to the Belfast Good Friday Agreement and the necessity of making sure that you know, that American influence wouldn't get lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think you and I have talked about a little bit. There's an awful lot of people taking credit for the Good Friday Agreement. And when I wrote that article for the Irish Times, I was just pointing out, without Bill Clinton, without George Mitchell, there is no Good Friday Agreement whatsoever. And I think if you look at the man who made it happen more than any, it's George Mitchell. And I think if you look at the influence of the Americans, I don't think it would have happened without Bill Clinton. And I just wanted to remind the Irish people who are talking about, you know, the great work done at the time and conveniently ignoring the role of Irish America, that, you know, we were right there. We took risks for peace. We went to Northern Ireland. We talked to Sinn Féin and helped them bring to fruition the idea of a ceasefire for the American visitors. So there was an awful lot of things that were done. And with the 25th, I can't believe it's 25 years later.
I know.
With the 25th anniversary coming up, I wanted to point out that Bill Clinton will be in Belfast, Joe Biden will be in Belfast, Hillary Clinton will be in Belfast. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary recognition of what was achieved to get two American presidents coming to Ireland. I don't know if they're coming at the same time, but I know they're both coming, yeah, trying to arrange schedules around the Good Friday date. But yeah, it just shows you how incredibly important the impact of Irish America was. And I thought, yeah, that was getting lost in the self-congratulations that was going on in Ireland. So I wrote, yeah, the article. Yeah.
You know, and again, I think that, you know, the timing is right, because somehow we have, you know, a habit of, you know, grouping in, you know, the President of the United States and his influence through, it can be said, Senator George Mitchell, who was assigned as envoy to Northern Ireland, and that's what did it. Now, this interview is going much too smoothly than I wanted to be. So let me ask.
Well,
you,
I was
Mr.
just
Jones,
saying that George Mitchell spent 5 years in a hotel in Northern Ireland, waiting and putting together the bits and pieces that led to the Good Friday Agreement. Can you imagine if he was in a hotel in Mayo?
Mm.
Yeah, the poor man would probably have jumped in the river in the Moy.
He would have not.
Yeah.
He would have stayed on. I just want to ask you, Mr. Democrat, journalist, big mouth,
yes,
what is the story and how do we account for, despite the, you know, ancient order of Hibernians, despite the fact that, you know, we have spelled out in every segment, particularly in the Irish-American community in the United States, what is the problem with, you know, and I hate to do this because he's a fellow Ballinai man, with Joe Biden? What's the holdup? Why is something so blatant as not assigning an American envoy to Northern Ireland at a time when it was never as divided as it is right now? What's your take on that?
Honestly, Adrian, I don't know what's going on. The one thing I had heard was that Sullivan, who's the National Security Advisor, had told some senior Irish government figures that he would be handling the issue himself because he was very familiar with it. But he's now right in the middle of the Ukrainian negotiations. And, you know, obviously a much bigger issue for him to deal with. Anytime we bring up the special envoy, they say, well, Biden will do whatever we want him to do. And we know that that is true. But there should be an American voice always at the table when the future of Northern Ireland is discussed, both before and after such things as presidential visits. Because it's incredibly important, as was proved during the original fight for the visa or the fight for the Good Friday Agreement, that American influence used properly has a huge positive impact. And I see no reason whatsoever why there should not be a Northern Ireland envoy. When you think of Richard Haass, when you think of George Mitchell, when you think of all the people who went over and did a great job, basically, you really begin to wonder, you know, is there somebody in there that's opposing this? Because it must be that. Because it's actually, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah. But I think if we reflect, go back to the election of President Bill Clinton, and, you know, again, giving credit to John Deary as we go back there to that time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, having, you know, before elections, getting commitment from presidential candidates what they would and would not do. There was, you know, a few months into his reign in the White House, you know, you had the, again, the Paul O'Dwyer's, the whole group at that point.
Yeah.
They weren't waiting. They simply were not waiting to see, you know, when Bill Clinton would start moving on it. And they were angry. They were just, you know.
Yeah, they had got a commitment at that famous meeting in the Sheraton.
Yeah.
That he, you know, he would appoint a special envoy. And initially, you remember David Dinkins wrote a letter and the message came back that they weren't going to do it. So we became very annoyed, actually, and put forward a very strong position paper as to why he should be appointing a special envoy, among other things.
Mm.
And that worked. But the Biden administration, you know, it just seems to not be interested at the level of the community. You know that Biden would do the right thing when it comes to Brexit or whatever, but it's not something that the administration appears to be in the least bit interested in any meaningful way in terms of an individual in there. I mean, if you were to pick up the phone during the days of Bill Clinton, you could talk to Nancy Soderbergh, a very senior advisor to the president. There's absolutely nobody in the Biden White House that you can pick up the phone to and realize, you know, the Irish community will be getting through to somebody of major influence.
Yeah. Well, again, I think actually it should be, you know, Brian O'Dwyer, let him answer what's holding it up. You know, he's getting a smooth right now. And again, very influential Irish-American committee, which, you know, one can say deserves their own recognition for getting President Biden there in the first place. Now, can I ask you for your opinion on Northern Ireland, on the situation as it stands right now, the distraction of Brexit, and the fact that Ireland, which for 800 years is looking for, you know, self-rule and self-domination, how are we supposed to explain to others who would say, you mean there's no assembly in Ireland tonight? What's holding it up?
Yeah. I think the way to explain it is to understand that two things. One, the British had four prime ministers in a year, which was unbelievable. The good news is the new guy, Sunuk, I think that's his name, did I get it right? That he is much better, apparently, from what I've been told, just in terms of not insulting the Irish, but taking them seriously. And I think that's a good start. But I think we're running into the same brick wall, Adrian, which is Geoffrey Donaldson refusing, despite the fact that an election was held, he's refusing to go into government. Basically, I think because Sinn Féin would be in charge of the government because they had the most seats. But that's democracy. That's the very same as what we're talking about over here.
Yeah.
You can't go into an election and say, if we don't win, we're not going to accept the results.
Right.
I mean, it's completely insane. And that's what Donaldson has done. And
yeah.
How you change
but
it...
But you know, you just mentioned here from... those in glass houses should not throw stones. It's not like we have, you know, the solution to our own problems, never mind in Northern Ireland. But your article in the Irish Times, for the first time, gave a rough plan of action for, you know, a united Ireland, and that went, you know, that would sell on its own. But you gave a date, you gave a year, and the reasons why it would take from now until 2030 to even have, you know, you know, not only discussions, but that's the earliest time that you see the whole notion of a united Ireland. There are some who think it should come next week, and there are those who say it would never happen, and Ireland free from the centre to the sea. It might sound great in songs, but it's not going to happen. What?
Well, you know, there are people who said the Good Friday Agreement would never happen, that the IRA would never give up guns, that Gerry Adams would never go into politics. You know, there's a million things have happened. But what I was trying to say in the article was, in 2030, which is now 7 years, just about 8 years from now, there would be another census, as there is every 10 years. And this new census will reveal that whereas now it's 50-50 with a slight advantage to the nationalists, it'll have gone about 5 to 6 points further in favour of the nationalists, which will be 60%, say, close to 60% of the nationalists will say, of the Northern Ireland population, will be nationalist, Catholic, whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the unionists were smart, they would do their deal now, because in 10 years, and then you go on another 10 years, and the next census after that will be 15 to 20% more nationalists. So it's inevitable. It's going to happen. We need to prepare for it. The only solution that makes any sense is to sit down, everybody sit down with no hard and fast opinions that can't be changed, and say, look, if you're an ultra unionist, do you also want to have Irish citizenship? Do you want to have European citizenship? Do you want to have seats in the Parliament in Dublin guaranteed to you? Do you want a minister, a permanent minister in an Irish government? Do you want to keep the Assembly in Northern Ireland where you would rule what used to be Northern Ireland? Something like a regional parliament, like a state, like if the Michigan legislature or something. In other words, you give them everything you can in terms of smoothing the way. But in the end, Adrian, this is the most important point I made. Partition is over. It's over.
Mm.
It didn't work for 100 years, and the people of Northern Ireland are not going to allow it to fail for another 100 years. And the simple reason is there. It's in the Good Friday Agreement. 50 plus one, there's a section where the British government, when it becomes aware of the fact that there's a nationalist advantage, has to call a border poll. And I'm saying that rather than trying to stem the tide, why don't we say, yeah, this is happening, and what can we do to help make it happen in the best sense possible? But realizing that, you know, every year that passes, Northern Ireland's partition will start to disappear more and more.
Neil, again, as usual, we want to thank you, and that's a great number of issues there. So now, actually, you can go back to bed, and you don't have to.
Thank you. I was just going to put on my
your jammies.
Heat blanket.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Neil, yes. And Francie Ward, listening to Irish.